Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Imagine being about 36 years old, having completed only the sixth grade, and one day waking up in a hospital from knee surgery to a dream induced by morphine for your severe pain. In the unrelenting dream, you go to college, Harvard Law School, and then walk across the United States from Boston, Massachusetts to Big Sur, California. Those 63 words summarize the story of Donald L. Brown, now 67 years old, who had that dream and lived it. Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, Donald L. Brown is the author of The Morphine Dream, Delusions of Grandeur or Relentless Ambition. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. Donald L. Brown visited the studios of Radio Curious on November 9th, 2013, to share his story. We began our visit with his description of this morphine dream and how he lived it.
Morphine dream was an actual event. It wasn't really a dream. I was in a hospital after a bad accident that left me unable to walk, and I had been having a lot of surgery. And they put me under and did a nasty surgery. And because it was so nasty, they gave me morphine while I was still unconscious. And I woke up, and I was in a different world. I didn't recognize anything that was going on. The dream was that I would go to Harvard Law School and that I would walk across the country. And, of course, I had never gone beyond sixth grade, and I was told I would never walk again. So that was a kind of stupid dream. That's what everybody thought.
Did anybody discuss the analysis of that dream with you?
Yeah, my doctor came in not too long after I'd had the dream and asked me how I was doing. And I said, well, I'm fine. I'm going to Harvard Law School, and I'm going to walk across the country. And he said to the nurse, I don't know what you're giving him, but don't give him any more.
From a psychiatric point of view, did you ever have that experience?
Yeah, I had a lot of therapy at that time because I was in tough shape because I couldn't walk. And my doctor would, my psychiatrist would tell me not to make such outlandish dreams because they would be very difficult to accomplish. And I should stick to things that I knew more about and not put pressure on myself to do things that were so incredibly distant.
Was there a suggestion by the psychiatrist that you should control your dreams?
Yes, and that I was grandiose and having big dreams. Well, I never thought anything was wrong with that. I just felt like from the moment I had it, I knew I was going to do it, and I never, ever doubted it. And for the years that it took me to accomplish the dreams, I never thought I wasn't going to do it. A lot of other people did, but I never thought that way. And when it was time to go on the walk, my orthopedic doctor said, you can't do this. I said, I'm going to do it. He said, I know. I'm not even going to try to stop you, but I know you're going to do it, but you're not going to be able to do it. And I said, yes, I am. And I went with a smile all the way across the country. I never had any trouble. It was really good for me.
But that walk across the country occurred after community college, Amherst College, and Harvard Law School.
That's correct.
Preparatory for the walk.
Yes.
How did those events prepare you to walk 5,000 miles?
Well, the persistence that you need to go to community college and have that be translated into getting into Amherst College and Harvard Law School was hard, hard work. I mean, you have to be able to make yourself work hard, and I could do that. And, of course, when I was facing doing the walk, that wasn't a question. I knew I could do the walk. I knew I could do the work. The questions were more related to could I afford to do it and so forth, not would I do it or could I do it. I knew I could do it.
Afford economically.
Yeah. I wasn't sure I could afford it, but I sold my company, and that provided me with the funds I needed to be able to do it and also leave enough money back for my family to be able to do fine during the time I was gone. But it was part of my life at that point. I had to do it. It was necessary for me to complete my dreams, because if I didn't complete my dreams, it was kind of foolish to have them in the first place.
So the walk began on Independence Day in 1997 and went through about the middle of November
That's
of that
correct.
Year.
Yes.
Okay. I heard you say that the walking was easy.
Yes.
But the mental part of continuing walking was hard.
Yes.
What was hard about it?
Well, you know, when you're doing something that's so consuming, and it's 13 hours a day of walking, sometimes you get really bored, and other times you think about, why am I doing this? Why don't I just stop and go back home? And the games you play with yourself, with your mind telling you, let's stop this. We don't need to do this anymore. You know, you don't have any to prove anything to anybody. And of course I didn't, but I had to prove something to myself that I could do my dream.
Tell us more. You had to prove something to yourself that you could do your dream. What's the background on that?
Well, you know, I came from a family that was disjointed, dysfunctional. Not too many people in my family did much with their lives. And I was caught up in that same kind of sea of uncertainty of never knowing what life meant and what life could be and what the possibilities were. And there was no music and no books and no theater in my life. None of that stuff that's so important to me today. And when I finally got to the point where I had the dream and I started to go to college and started to do well in college, then I began to think that I could do things like other people and I could achieve big things. So pursuing the dream, and especially pursuing walking across the country, it was very important to me to continue to prove to myself that I could do things like other people and I could do things that were, you know, hard to reach but required diligence and perseverance and hard work. And of course, what it all proved to me in the end is that we can do anything. Human beings can accomplish anything if they'll just dream and do it. Dream it and do it. That's been my slogan ever since. And if you have the courage to dream and then the methodical attention to detail to make the plan and then execute the plan, you can do anything. And everybody can, and that's what the book is for. I want people to realize they can do whatever they want to do.
I want to go back to disjointed and dysfunctional. Is the characterizations of your family home as a child and your family.
Yes.
Can you describe how it was for us?
Well, my father was an Irish dirt farmer. He had never done anything in his life except farm. And of course, as part of that, there was no music, books, television, or anything. We didn't even have heat in our house or running water or things like that. And never did I ever hear anybody say the words, I love you, to each other. Never. Of course, I never did anything until I was in my late 30s. I was nothing but an athlete and a laborer. And, you know, being an athlete may be glamorous to a lot of people, but it's really nothing more than selling your body into the highest bidder. I mean, you go out and you leave your body in your career. You know, at the end of your career, you need surgery every year. And it's a strange way to spend your life selling your body for money. But that's what I did. And then after that, I became a factory worker because I couldn't get another job. I didn't have any education. I didn't have any experience. After being an athlete for so many years, when it was time to get a job, I didn't know how to do anything. Being an athlete doesn't give you any experience to hold down a job afterwards, after your career. So it was, kind of a tough thing to get to that stage of life and realize you can only be a laborer in a factory doing a dirty job and having a hell of a time with the requirements of the job. And when I got hurt and when I started to go to college, that changed my life completely.
Well, Don Brown, I want to hear about that. the change in your life and your walk across the country. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Donald L. Brown, who, with Gary S. Chaffetz, is the author of The Morphine Dream, Delusions of Grandeur or Relentless Ambition. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Don, the trip across the country, you saw how many states?
21.
In 137 days.
Yes, and I walked through 2,000 cities and towns, and the 11 million steps, as you said. And when I got to Big Sur and finished going through Big Sur, I walked into the ocean, and that was the end. That was where I wanted to get to, Big Sur. I had seen that all my life, and I wanted to go see it for real. So I did it.
And that was when you said, what shall I do with the rest of my life?
That was when I got kind of depressed and upset, because I was sitting in the sitting in the ocean, just kind of relishing the fact that I had done the dream. But then I realized I didn't know what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And it was a very difficult pill to swallow at the moment. But as I sat there over a period of a half an hour, I began to think, well, you know, it's clear that I just have to keep dreaming. I have to keep creating dreams. And I sat there and created dreams, like I was going to go back to Massachusetts and write a book about my walk across the country, which I eventually did, and that I was going to go back and do other things, and I did them all, everything I ever dreamed of. And then, of course, when I published this book, my dream was to go out around the country and promote it so that people everywhere would hopefully benefit from being able to find out about this book and read it, because in the book is the message about how to do it, how you, anybody, can do what I did, reach your dreams.
And going around the country is what brings you here to the studios of Radio Curious in Ukiah, California.
On my way to Portland, Oregon, from about 12 days in California, starting in San Diego and working my way up to Santa Rosa, and tomorrow on to Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, and then heading east, going home for Thanksgiving.
Well, Don Brown, is there more that you can tell us about achieving the goals?
Well, of course, the biggest thing and the most difficult part of achieving the goals is identifying the goals. But once you identify them and you make a plan, then the execution of that plan has to go forward every moment. You have to focus and focus and focus and say to yourself, I am going to do it. I am going to get there. And move one step at a time towards reaching it, never letting anything knock you off that trail, because you've got to keep going.
Let's back up. The most difficult thing is identifying the goals.
Yes.
Address for us how a person can identify the goals.
Well, you have to search inside yourself and understand what it is you really want to do.
When you search, what do you look for? You say, what do I really want to do? And getting over the hump, if you will, of I can't do it, I don't know the words to express it, I have an urge, but I don't know what the urge is leading me to. Or other kinds of blocks that people may have.
That's true. I had that block for many years. I didn't know what I was reaching for. But when I was in the hospital and had the ideas about going to Harvard and walking across the country, I was finally developing the ideas. And I didn't let how strange they were or how difficult they were defeat it before I tried. Because I had been listening to a motivational speaker, Anthony Robbins, and he said, write where you want to be in 5 years. And I wrote Harvard Law School, and I wrote the list of what I had to do to get there. And he said, now just move towards that and never stop thinking of anything except what you have defined as your goals. And do all the things and keep moving forward one step at a time. Don't ever stop. Because if you let something knock you off, you're probably never going to get back on. So I never let anything take you out of the mindset of reaching your goals. And your goals can be anything. There's no reason to say, oh, I can't do that or I can't do that. A human being can do anything. And I've watched it in my lifetime, especially over the last 20 or 30 years. I've watched a lot of people do their dreams because they put it in their mind that that's what they're going to do, and they just keep going until they get it done. I taught my children to dream that way, and my children had great dreams, and they made them all. And I go to talk to high school kids today. I was just speaking in San Diego. There were 1,200 kids in the auditorium. I said, how many of you have been taught how to dream? None. Nobody. We don't even teach our young people how to dream. The most important thing in life is dream and plan and execute for what you want out of life. And we don't even teach them that. And, you know, that's how I got to be 38 years old and never had a dream. That's how my father lived till he was 44 and never had a dream. Dreaming wasn't part of life. Well, dreaming is life. That's what life is. Do your dreams and make sure you do them. Dream it and do it. And we should start by teaching young people every day of their lives, dream. Dream big. And I taught my kids that, and they did all their dreams. I never told them what to dream. I just said, dream. And it was easy to teach my children. And from little boys, they had dreams, and they've done them all. And, you know, to me, it's just like watching life. That's life. Dream it and do it.
Your dream to walk across the country. Can you give us a few of the highlights beyond Big Sur, where you walked into the ocean?
The highlights were not about the physical part of the walk or the scenery, and even though it was beautiful, the highlights were the people I met and the thoughts that I had and the solitude. I think probably the highlight of the whole trip was the solitude, that I had 13 hours a day to think about life and to think about things that I wanted to do and things that I wanted to say, speaking to people and so forth. And I spent those 130 days, whatever, just thinking about what my life was about. Not about the future, but just about what it had been.
What were those highlights?
That you could do this system of dreaming and doing. It was possible to do it. And from where I had come from, no one would ever expect me to have done those things that I dreamed. Yet I was able to do it, and it was a great lesson in life and about being able to put together your thoughts and your assets and move towards a goal and do it. And we can all do it. And that was the thing that was so wonderful, to find out that Tony Robbins was right.
What would you say to someone who has a dream and there's no money to pursue it?
Well, money is not part of dreams. I mean, that
it's part of the actualization of them.
Well, it may be part of the list of what you have to do to reach your dreams, whatever it is, go out and do it. I know a Vietnamese couple in Newton, Massachusetts, that had a dream to send their children to college, 5 children. They went out and picked cans out of the garbage in the city of Newton for about 10 years and raised $250,000 to send their kids to school. So their dream included they needed some money to pay for the kids to go to college. And they did what they had to do. They went out and picked cans every night, and they'd be out there almost all night long picking cans for a nickel apiece out of the garbage so their kids could go to college. So you do whatever you got to do, because that's the plan is the list of all the things you have to do. And if part of it is getting some money together, well, figure out a way. And the way I did it was, when I sold my business, I negotiated an extra $50,000 on the sale to pay for my walk across the country.
There's two people you went to Harvard Law School that I'd like you to comment about. The first is Steve Emery, who goes by the name of Mato Tanka.
Yes. My first day at law school, I met Steve, and it was obvious that he was also an older student as I was, and he had been a police officer for the Yankton Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, and he had never gone to high school. He was the only person ever at Harvard Law School, so he thought, that never went to high school. But I was there too, and we both never went to high school, and we were there together. And we became kin really fast. We were like brothers. And I still see him often. I'm on my way there in a couple of weeks, as a matter of fact. And instead of leaving Harvard Law School and going out to work in a big fancy law firm like most people would, he went back to his tribe to help his tribe because his grandfather told him, your job is to go get this wonderful education and then come back here and help your tribe. And that's what he's still doing back there in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, and I try to help him as much as I can, too. And he's a very special person, and I've learned a lot about Native America. I teach Native American history. Part of it is because of my interest in his tribe and my interest in following the history of Native Americans because of his commitment to the tradition of his tribe. And he's just a very special person, and you know, I have great warmth for him. He is like my brother, and there's no question about that. He's closer to me than any of my brothers were.
The other classmate of yours was Barack Obama.
Yes. An incredible human being. I mean, there's a lot of discourse in this country about whether he's a good president or not, and I don't even want to get involved in any of that discussion. All I know is Barack Obama, the human being, has to be perhaps the finest human being I ever met. I mean, he is just a superb human being and very kind and very compassionate, never disrespectful to anybody ever. I have never seen him be disrespectful. And it was a pleasure to know him there. And then as years went by and it became obvious that he was going to become the president of the United States, what a thrill that this guy would do that. Because my next book out is, there's a chapter about him becoming president, and I wrote it in 1989. It was my law school third year paper, and I have since expounded upon it and expanded it. But, you know, that paper back then in the permanent collection of the Harvard Law School Library predicted that Barack Obama would become the president in 2004. And I predicted that he would beat Newt Gingrich in the presidential election after winning a Senate seat from Teddy Kennedy. And, of course, it didn't happen that way, but it did happen. And to me, as a historian, I believe that the election of Barack Obama to the presidency is the greatest single event in the history of the world. I don't know anything that significant. Because for a black man to be elected president in this country, it seemed that was never possible for it to happen. Yet it did. And every little black kid in this country who used to be able to say, I can't be president of the United States, so I'm not really free. It's not true anymore. And he said it to them the night he got elected. He said, yes, we can. And it's true.
Well, Don Brown, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, a couple of questions.
Yes.
An epiphany or a eureka moment in your life that changed the way you live, what would that be?
Well, you know, I had this very strange event in my life that's recounted in the book. I had sold my family's landscape construction business back in the 70s to a friend, and I had to stay working for him. And one morning he and I were pruning shrubs at a fancy estate, and I was sitting there thinking about, what am I doing? This is not what my life should be. And for some unknown reason, he looked over at me and he said, Brownie, get out of here. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you're lost. Take the summer off. He said, I'll pay you. Just take the summer off and go and find yourself.
How old were you?
I was 34, 35. So I took the summer off and I went with my wife to Phoenix, Arizona, and many places along the way. And we're driving along the highway in Arkansas, and there was a sign, baskets, next exit. And my wife said, Brownie, get off here. I want to get a basket. So I got off, and I picked up a Strout Realty catalog about farm properties for sale all over the country. And in that catalog, I found a beautiful farm in Massachusetts that sounded fabulous. And I showed it to her, and she agreed. And we drove from that place directly to Orange, Massachusetts. And about 5 minutes after we got there, we bought the place. And I finally realized I found the place. And then I realized quickly after that it wasn't about the place. But it was there, working in a factory, I got hurt. And when I got hurt, I wound up in community college, Amherst College, and so forth. I think back to the guy saying to me, get out of here. You lost.
And it was when you got hurt that you had the morphine dream.
Yes.
What would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
To do what I'm doing. Write books, sell books, have movies made, and take all the money. I have it all in an irrevocable trust and give it to charities and the schools I went to and my children and things that help seniors. I've been paying for books on tape so people can get my books that can't see. And, of course, when you do that, you don't get any royalties, but I don't care. I want people to get the book. I want people to hear the things I have to say that might help them have a better life because I know it worked for me. And I was a nobody, and it worked for me. So I don't care who you are. You can take the lessons that I learned and use them yourself. And in my book, they're all in there. You know, the whole recipe is there. And, of course, the recipe is there how to get into the finest colleges in this country and go for nothing.
Next year, 2014, you're having 6 books released. Yes. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, the first one is a book that I wrote at Harvard Law School. It's about race and law and race relations in our country. And the last chapter was a prediction that I made in 1989 about Barack Obama becoming president. The next two are sequel books to A Man-Child in the Promised Land and Coming of Age in Mississippi. And then the fourth one is The Miracle of Lou. That's a book about my son, Lou, who was born with only a quarter of a brain and who today is about to go to Harvard Law School. And then the fifth one is Made in Amherst, and it's about my 3 years at Amherst and what a special time that was for me. And then the sixth one is about a very famous black professor at Harvard Law School, Derrick Bell, who was the first black tenured professor in a law school. And he was my mentor and the mentor of several well-known people like Barack Obama and his wife and Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts. And he died last year, and I spoke at his memorial sessions, and then I was asked to write a book about him. And he had written a book near the end of his life called And We Are Not Saved, The Permanence of Racism. So I am writing a book, And We Are Saved, The Legacy of Derrick Bell, because of him and the people who are his mentees out there around the world working for racial justice, we are going to be saved. We're going to see a day when racism doesn't play such a major role in our country.
And finally, Don Brown, can you recommend a book to our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my favorite things to do. My favorite book of all time, I believe, is The Glass Castle. And it's kind of interesting because it's a book by a woman who writes about her dysfunctional upbringing, and it turns out pretty good for her. And
what's her name?
Her name is Jeanette Walls. And the book was fantastic.
Well, Donald Loring Brown, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's really nice to be here and do an interview with you live in the studio.
Donald L. Brown is the author of The Morphine Dream, Illusions of Grandeur or Relentless Ambition. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. He's also the author of several other books that will be published in 2014. The book that Donald L. Brown recommends is The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. This interview was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on November 9, 2013. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.